Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by the Boston University Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Speaking will be the Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds on My Life, My Love, My Legacy, the autobiography of Coretta Scott King. Moderating the discussion is the Reverend Dr. Robert Allen Hill, Dean of Boston University's Marsh Chapel. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Board of Trustees member and president and CEO of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, Andrea Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me here today and allowing me to be part of this very special occasion. And I'm really honored to participate in this Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Lecture. And Reverend Dr. Robert Allen Hill, the Dean of Marsh Chapel and Boston University's religious leader, will be a part of the program. Dean Hill is a devoted pastor and educator whose 41-year career in ministry has influenced many, many decades of teaching. And he's also the author of 11 books. And Dean Hill has taught at universities across North America, including McGill, Syracuse University, and Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School. Dean Hill grounds his expressions of faith in the tradition of a responsible Christian liberalism, and we are very proud and pleased to have you here today, Dean Hill. Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds is an ordained minister, a veteran journalist, an award-winning columnist who interviewed Presidents Reagan, Carter, and Clinton. She has written for many major magazines and newspapers, including the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, Ebony, Essence, and USA Today, where she was a columnist and editorial board member for 13 years. She was the first African-American woman to hold that position. She has appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show, on CNN, C-SPAN, MSNBC, and hosted her own satellite radio show for almost a decade. She holds a bachelor's degree in journalism, a master's degree in religious studies, and a doctorate in pastoral counseling, and is the author of several books. Dr. Reynolds has received numerous civic, religious, and academic awards and accolades, including the 1987 Southern Christian Leadership Conference Martin Luther King Jr. Drum Major for Justice Award, and the History Makers Award for Outstanding Leadership. And as a board member of History Makers, I'm very excited to know that about your background. In 2014, she was inducted into the Board of Preachers at the 29th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. International College of Ministers and Laity at Morehouse College, and she serves on the Board of Advisors for Major Gun Violence Reform, a key issue of our time, with Black Women for Positive Change. She also founded Harriet's Ministry, a weekly healing conversation for women who are addicted to alcohol and drugs. But what we're here to talk about this evening is her work with Coretta Scott King. And Dr. Reynolds first met Coretta Scott King while she was on assignment as a writer to do a cover story featuring Mrs. King for the Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine. And this 30-year friendship developed and led to the creation of the book that we're going to hear more about this evening, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, a book which has brought us all together and which I commend to you. I did have a chance to read it on my electronic devices. I've been traveling around these past few days. And of the book, Essence Magazine says, "In My Life, My Love, My Legacy, legendary journalist Barbara Reynolds reveals never-before-told aspects of Mrs. King's life, and we learn of her brilliant mind, her courageous spirit, and the woman behind that enigmatic figure." And USA Today called the book eloquent and inspirational. I'd like you to please help me welcome the Reverend Dr. Robert Allen Hill and our special guest of honor, the Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for those gracious and warm words. Really heartening, humbling, and we appreciate it very much. And good evening, one and all. We are going to engage, we have the happy delight and privilege of engaging in conversation itself, a wonderful means of grace. especially in this evening hour. We're going to engage here in a 30 or 40 minute conversation that will help us to engage in the book before us. And I also have had the real joy of reading through the book, and there will be some things maybe that we can attend to there. But welcome to Boston, and welcome to Boston University, and we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Listen, as we get going here, and before we talk in full about the life of Coretta Scott King, would you mind telling this group a little bit about how this memoir came together 10 years after her death? You do go into it at the very end. There's an afterword that tells some of this story, but most of us, most of the group here hasn't read the book yet, so they might be interested in knowing how the memoir itself came together and how this voice that you present to us so beautifully emerged.
Well, if your question is just about how the memoir came together 10 years after it started, that's the story in itself. But the first problem was I had written two biographies. And as you know, when you write a biography, you can give your opinion, you can use research, but when you write a memoir, you have to get into the tone, you have to get in the mind, you have to get in the soul of your person. And what it was, I was still Barbara. Mm-hmm. And Barbara can't write a memoir about Coretta if she's going to be Barbara. I have to be Coretta. And we're two different kinds of people. She's gracious. Keith is still trying to teach me how to be gracious. I'm still learning. So the first time I had it done, it was not right because I was writing about her and not through her. The second time it became a part of a lawsuit, and we didn't get it done then. And then the third time, I think you appreciate it that Bernice King and I are both ministers. And I would keep saying, you know, if two ministers can't agree and get this thing done, I don't know who can. And so, but I appreciated her in this regard. When someone comes through the birth canal of someone, are you going to argue with them and think that you know better than they do about their mother? No. I'd have a sentence. I said, this is correct. She says, but it's not what she meant. That's frustrating, you know. Then I say, okay, is this what she meant? The tone isn't right. But, you know, through it all, I didn't want to write a book that Coretta's children could say, I don't recognize her. And when you have three children, think about your own family, you know, and they would all have a different perspective. So, you know, I had to wait till I know that they could look at this book and say, that's my mother. And when Bernice said to me, reading the book made me fall in love with my mother all over again, I really think it was right. So it had to be right. That's why it took so long. But I would never write another memoir, I'll tell you that.
That sounds fair enough.
Yeah. But,
maybe if you don't mind, and this is very fully described in the book, would you mind saying something a little bit about Coretta Scott before her time with Martin Luther King and maybe a bit about her upbringing and a bit about Antioch and something of that sort?
Well, when I talk about Coretta, we have to get away from this comfortable place where we sit today, because Coretta was born in Marion, Alabama, and when she was 15, white haters burned her house down. Then they burned her father's businesses down twice. This was in the 50s and the 40s, the 1895 Plessy v. Ferguson Supreme Court decision of separate but equal was still in force. Blacks did not have the vote at all. When her house burned down, It's no use trying to get the police, because the police didn't care, because to them, they did not count. So you're talking about the deepest, darkest time of segregation and hate that was also rampant across the South. Her uncle had been lynched. When they would go to a movie theater, of course, they had to sit on the top row. They couldn't go down the front row. She had to move off the sidewalk when whites came by. So her first introduction to life was of terrorism. The hand of God, I might say, intercepted this whole life, because she did have a very strong Baptist church upbringing that helped her counter this hostility that she had to work through. Her mother had a dream of her going to college, so she did get to go to Lincoln School. And there she had white teachers, and she began to see a different attitude of people who were not like her, but really wanted her to be somebody. She began to understand she could sing, and that she had talent. And she had to do this. You know, God seemed to put her where the divine dimension began to just prepare her way, because she had to see that the all white people were not terrorists. I hate to say this, but if you just seen people burning your house down and talk of lynching, you may not have a good view of what white people were at that time. So she went to Lincoln, and she saw a whole different view. Then she went to Antioch College, which was the first college to accept black students. And this was a very progressive college. She met Bayard Rustin, and she began to understand that there was a bigger world out here, and that she began to understand that where she started was not where she would have to end up. Mm-hmm. And so that was really where she started, mm-hmm. and how, leaving Antioch, she got to Boston, mm-hmm. to the New England Conservatory of Music. Mm-hmm. But it was a very harsh life, but it prepared her. And I'm going to skip to the Montgomery bus boycott, if it's okay.
Sure.
As some of you know, the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, blacks had to, this was the most humiliating experience you can think of. Here's the bus, right here, we'll say right there. And a black person had to go to the front of the bus, put the money in, get off the bus, and go all the way to the back. Sometimes the bus would take off. If there were seats like this front row, these were whites. And you could not sit in those seats, even if they were empty. Sometimes other women had tried to file suit, but it didn't happen. So here we are. They decided to have a bus boycott. They just would not get on the bus. They would do like Thoreau, who talked about don't cooperate with evil. They took that to heart. They walked in dignity instead of riding in shame. But walking just set up a furor of hate. Every day Coretta King receives hateful calls. We're going to kill you. We're going to kill your daughter. She didn't believe that this would really happen. But one night she was at home with her daughter, Yoki. Yolanda was 2 weeks old. There was a thud on the front of the porch, and the whole front of the porch blew off. Somebody had firebombed their house. So the next day, Dr. King Sr. came, and Dr. King Sr. was a big, impressive man, a powerful preacher, and he said, Coretta, I'm taking you out of here, and the baby. You're not going to stay here in Montgomery. You're getting out of here. And it was hard for her. She's 28, you know? But she said then, she said, I'll have to tell you, I'm married to Martin, but I'm also married to the movement, and I am prepared to die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, And he often said if she had left Montgomery, he would have left. Because, and then there would not have been a movement. But can you see the courage of someone who says, I am prepared to die for what I believe? And so, you know, that is one of the things that drew me near her when I met her. Because, see, I had been in the civil rights movement in 1965. I had gone to Tennessee to try to register blacks to vote. The voting rights law had passed, but we had to test it. And we did not know. I was born in Ohio. So we didn't understand racism. We saw something on Selma and couldn't get it right because our parents did not teach us. The schools didn't tell us. So our friends at Ohio State was all races. We got together, our friends. Let's go south and figure out what's going on. I think I was in my early 20s. And so we linked up in a movement in Brownsville, Tennessee. And so they put us in homes with blacks, people that would let us stay. And they told us, they said, now, don't go out after dark. But we had no concept that a brown face or black face could get you killed. Yeah. We just did not know. Soon as the lights went out, all the adults went to bed. What do you think we did? We went out. We had seen a place when we were driving into the city where you could dance. And we said, well, we're going to go out and dance. And so we walked in this roadside inn. We saw white men standing there, but we hadn't been taught that they hated us. We did not know. And we walked in there, and they pulled the jukebox cord out the wall and said, get them. And we ran and jumped into our cars, and they chased us for miles and miles. The next day, there was a roadblock, and we got around that, too. And when I got out of the South, I said, I'll never come back. There's no way I'm coming back, you know. But I tell you this story so you understand how much I respect the Coretta King. You see what I'm saying? Because it's one thing, you can say, I'm brave, I'm strong, but if you never test it, you just can say anything you want to. But when I saw what could happen, I said, oh, you won't get me back here, not another day, not another time. But this woman had the threats against her every day of her life, not every day, but so often. And on top of that, the Hoover, the FBI, was following her and spreading rumors about her husband. And when I measured myself against this woman, I could not believe that there was a woman that could get out of danger and every day faced it. She was courageous. And I said, I got to really write about this woman because I never met a woman like that. I mean, I've seen people who weren't in danger say, I'm brave, I'm strong. But I never met a woman who was in danger and could say, this is a cause I will die for.
You know, thank you so much. You mentioned as we were beginning a bit about, speaking of courage, about the way that Martin and Coretta came together and got to know each other in Boston, not very far from where we're sitting tonight, in your book, in a memorable detail, describes some of that courageous beginning. They really had to make some decisions fairly quickly, and they had some support, but they also had some questions from some of the family. But they moved ahead, and I just, because we're here in Boston tonight, I thought maybe you'd like to say a bit about how Coretta and Martin came together.
Well, there was a matchmaker, and you know about matchmakers. They always try to hook somebody up, you know? And so this matchmaker, Martin ran into this woman, and they became friends, and he just said, you know, I wish I could find a woman of good character that's beautiful and intelligent. I mean, I just can't seem to find the right woman. And Beverly, I tell you what happened. This matchmaker said, I know just the woman. And she's beautiful, she's intelligent, and she's of good character. And so she gave Martin Coretta's phone number, and he called her, and Martin said, "Where do you live, Coretta?" And she told him it was on Massachusetts Avenue somewhere. And she said, he said, "Usually takes me 7 minutes to get there, but I'll get there in 5. And so, you know, she was all excited, and I can see him rushing. You know, I'm supposed, you know, he disobeyed the traffic signals and all that, rushing to see her. And so when he got out the car, she said, "Oh, he's so short, you know." And he was pledging Alpha. And so he had shaved off his mustache and everything. But they got in the car, and the more he talked to her, the taller he grew, you know. And so in 4 hours, he said, "You are so beautiful, and you're so nice, and you're smart, and you're just the kind of woman I want to marry." And, you know, she's trying to say, "Wait a minute." But it really was love at first sight. And then she cooked him this great dinner of cornbread and cabbage smothered in potatoes and pork chops. And he knew then that was the one. He knew. So, but it was, you know, and we can't forget that this was a love story. She loved him, and she wanted to be his wife. And to have, they went to Montgomery, and he was a pastor of Dexter, a church, and she wanted to be your first lady and sing in the choir. She didn't think that she was going to be thrust into Montgomery bus boycott with threats on her life and have to teach her children how to live a normal life. That's not what she thought she would have. But she played the card that was dealt her. And that's what she ended up doing and playing it very well.
And if I remember right from the book, as they were coming together, at one point anyway, correct me if I have this wrong, Daddy King had some ideas about maybe some other eligible partners for Martin.
Right, exactly.
And so he raised some questions, she was able to handle that.
Yeah, he said, "You know how you talk in somebody's presence." Yeah, well, he was talking to his wife. He said, "There's that fine girl in Atlanta, and she's from a wonderful family. And I think that's the one for Martin." And Martin didn't say anything, you know, because he was always, you know, very quiet among his father. And Coretta was just seething, you know. I mean, to hear him talk about this other girl, and she's saying, so finally she stand up and said, "I have something to offer too." And that Martin Sr. didn't know what to say. I mean, because he just thought that, you know, after he talked it, that Martin would sort of kowtow and she would go on. And they kept dating in front of him. So finally he said, "Okay, you two are dating pretty heavy. Go ahead and get married." And so that was it. But through her life, that's what she thought. "I have something to offer too." When she started the King Center, the males who had supported Dr. King, they wouldn't support her. You know, she had to stand up for herself, often with the preachers. You know, you have to understand that sexism is not dead. It wasn't dead then. And when you see a woman like Hillary, who is the smartest, wisest person that was running in this election, don't get president, does not win, then you have to understand sexism is alive now, sexism was alive then, and we just have to recognize that. I don't know where that came. I had to talk about Hillary, you know, but.
We sometimes say, "Can I get an amen on that?"
Yes. But she had to fight the black preachers. And her thought was, even as we see through the book, you know, is I'm somebody too. You know, I'm a woman. Like he said once, they were in a little exchange. And he said, "I don't think you're happy just being my wife, you know, because at that time the men thought the women's just supposed to stay at home. And she said, yes, I'm very happy to be your wife and the mother of your children, but if that's all I had to do, I would go crazy. And so even when she got married, you know, to love, honor, and obey, she made him take the obey out. So she was an original feminist.
You know, it occurs to me, we have a number of students who are here with us tonight, and we're going to be moving in next year into a year of some memories of 50 years ago, which is long before many of these students were born. The civil rights movement had a number of critical moments in it, and you've talked a bit about this already. Are there one or two top chief central moments you'd like to make sure that across Boston University and into the next year or so we keep before us, focus on in recalling the civil rights movement?
Well, I think you should look at Selma and the way that that's what drew me into the civil rights movement, trying to say what in the world is going on. Mm-hmm. When blacks wanted to be Americans as we should be, and how in Selma, blacks trying to march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge were beaten with cattle prods, and I've seen women just dragged by the horsemen. I think that was the pivotal time when all of America said that we're not going to tolerate that. There's sometimes when we look at, because I think that there's mostly good in us, and sometimes we don't understand how other people live, but when they saw that brutality, there became a time when the Voting Rights Act was written. And this thing, it wasn't that one thing, but what you have to realize, Jimmie Lee Jackson, he was murdered. He was a martyr. It was a white minister, Reverend Lee, mm-hmm. and he was murdered. People were murdered just to get African Americans the right to vote. And then when we see, it was in blood that this happened. And so when we see people not exercising the vote, it's a stab in your heart when you think, you know, what people like Coretta and Dr. King and so many people. And then we have this whole surge now, you know, of Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, who, if you remember this letter that emerged, that was saying that Coretta King wrote to the Judiciary Committee that Strom Thurmond was head of, and for some reason the letter never surfaced. You think you have to figure out why it never surfaced. Yeah. But anyway, it did surface, and I think even from beyond the grave, she was saying, use your vote, you know, stand up for change, because Sessions is the person that went in around Marion, Alabama, where Coretta grew up, and filed charges against the civil rights people who were trying to register people to vote. So voting is so meaningful. We have suppression of voting rights right now. And what we thought we would never have to go through again, it looks like it's coming back again. So we always, I think Coretta said, in every generation, freedom is won and freedom is lost, and we have to be vigilant. Mm-hmm. I see so many young people out there. And I hope that, you know, because I don't think, I know Keith has the statistics, but, you know, there should have been more of all of us who voted. I mean, when you look at what's happening, it didn't have to happen. Yeah, all you had to do was vote, you know. People died to vote. And I've seen a lot of young people who said, we're not voting. Okay, you didn't vote, okay? What about the monies to your education? Some of us need health care. You know, maybe we don't have enough money that we own half of a wing or something, and we can get all the health care we want. You know, this affects you. So I think the vote yourself is the power you can put in your own hands. 2018, run to that poll and vote. Okay? Just run there.
You know, I don't know how the artistry of writing allows you to do what you do so well in this book. You have a full a panoply of events over many years, and then every now and then you'll just stop and go right into an anecdote or a moment that illumines so much. And one that was very moving, at least to me, and perhaps you'd say a word about it, was there was an event at which the president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, asked Martin Luther King to come to the White House. And Coretta asked if she could go. And there was a conversation, and it turned out that she couldn't, but she had a premonition that that might have been the only time.
Yeah. That's back to sexism again. Yeah. Now, here you think that Coretta King had been with her husband in every major march. If she couldn't march, she was at home making sure, because she did not have a rear view understanding of history. She understood that this was history as it was being made. So many of us will look back and then do history. She was compiling the history as it was going. She marched, you know, she made speeches for years. Her singing of concerts funded the movement for years. Mm-hmm. So we get to this wonderful event of the March on Washington and 1965. And she had asked Martin, can we march? No, you can't march. It's for leaders, but Dorothy Height was a leader, so why couldn't she march? The wonderful speech, and they're all up, oh, they're so inspired. So they get into the limousine to go see President Kennedy. And so when they get to the White House gate, they tell the women, well, you have to get out. Flag a cab and go on back to the Willard Hotel. Yeah. Can you imagine that? You're right at the gate. They open the gate and say, see you later, you know. And so they had to go back. They would not let the wives go in to see President Kennedy. And this was such a hurting thing because she really loved Kennedy because he had helped Martin get out of jail when he was jailed at Reidsville. And it was they was going to put him on the chain gang, and a call from him, and help turn this whole thing around. And she had that premonition: if I don't do it now, it'll never happen. So she never got to see President Kennedy. And you know, I should think tell you also about how do you live your life with the threat that you could die because you're trying to make the world better, the life better for other people. When Kennedy died, they used to talk about that. Well, if they can kill Kennedy, what chance does a Martin Luther King have if they can kill Kennedy? And even today, I do want to make sure I say a couple of things. Even today, in a last closing word, she says, please, get to the bottom of who killed King, because they had a civil trial in Memphis that people who were involved testified. They even named that it was a Memphis police person who shot him. They had a civil trial, and I go into it in the book, and the press didn't cover it. 2,000 reporters covered the O.J. Simpson story, and only two covered the civil trial of who killed Dr. King. But I do want to say a couple of things. I should have had this all out. But, you know, in in April, in April 27th, it will be the 90th birthday of Coretta King. And one day, my son and I were sitting around talking, and he said, isn't that something? She doesn't even have her own birthday. They celebrate her birthday on January 15th. I said, what? You know, it didn't hit me, but I couldn't let it go. Because I said, you know, that's not right. Just think, you know, if you and I, you know, very close, when you want your birthday, you know, to be celebrated? People celebrating my birthday or your that's birthday.
Right. September 26th.
Right, August 17th, the two different ones. So what she said, so we're starting a movement, which I want Boston to be a part of, on April 27th, and all that week, we're starting the first move to celebrate her birthday. So you can have a, I'm going to schools, to certain schools in Washington, and take cupcakes. I'm having a worship service at a Rankin Chapel at Howard University, where my son will be speaking. But do something. Because that's the way King holiday started. People just started, you know, celebrating his birthday. And then it just sort of got momentum. Of course, there was a lot of lobbying that she did until it became a nap. But do it because it's right. This woman should have her own birthday. It doesn't make any sense that she has to share. Her story is just now coming out of who she was. And we're going to have to celebrate her birthday on his birthday? No, I don't think so. So please help us celebrate this woman. But I do want to say one thing about what she wanted people to know. I was at the King Center a couple months ago on January 15th, and I saw this eternal flame, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it because there's the crypt. See, the King Center in Atlanta, there's a crypt here that contains Martin's remains and Coretta over here. But I kept looking at this eternal flame. Then I said, wow, that's in the book. That's why I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And she said, I want people to know that I was committed to leaving an eternal flame built on love that would never be extinguished. I wanted this flame to touch lives, communities, and nations. I wanted it to ignite and inspire. I wanted it to be an urgent call to community and public service. And sure, I've been through a lot, but every heartbreak preceded a breakthrough. Every thorn that pierced me positioned me for the next level of challenges. My story is a freedom song from within my soul. It is a story of struggle. It's about finding one's purpose, a guide to overcoming fear, and standing up for causes bigger than oneself. So when it's time for me to end this journey, I'll call it All Joy.
I have a whole list of other things that we'll talk about at another point. Thank you so very much. But I think our gathered audience here would like to have a chance to raise some things with you, if that's all right. So we'll turn to Andrea. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give another round of applause to Barbara Reynolds and Dr. Hill for what an inspiring and enlightening conversation. And again, the book is really, it's a page-turner, and it's very much a love story, and it's very much a story of feminism in that era and that time, which is really a perspective that we've never really seen or heard this Coretta Scott King before, and you've done a real service in putting voice and life into her story. And we now have an opportunity to ask questions, so I hope there are some questions in the room, and that you would be succinct in your question, and we can get a number of you to comment. Anyone who wants to go first? Yes.
Women rulers or even ordinary women seem to be left out of events, even though they are a crucial part of that event. I want to ask you about another woman who I think have been really marginalized, and that's the wife of Nelson Mandela. Because I just feel that there is something. I go on the web and I look for, you know, Nelson Mandela's wife. She's not there. She's been almost completely forgotten, and I wonder if you see some parallels.
Well, actually, Coretta did talk to Winnie Mandela when she went to South Africa, and she actually brought Winnie to Atlanta, and she was part of a march that she had. In fact, I even talked to Winnie Mandela. In fact, I met her in Richmond, Virginia, and she had asked me to do her biography. And she had a statue that they had presented her, and I was so engrossed in about this statue because it's made of wire, all of wire. And I didn't know in some African countries, if you really like something, they'll give it to you. You know, I won't do that here, but they do that there. And so she actually sent me a model of the statue. But, you know, I got a glimpse of her because, you know, she was accused of necklacing, where the enemies are put in tires and they burn it and them alive. I don't know whether she did it or not. I don't think Coretta knew. But I was in a hotel room with her. She had just given and Coretta used to tell me, she said, you have to understand, she does not believe in nonviolence. See, when he came to the King Center to try to learn how to be nonviolent, she was not. And so when I was in the hotel room with her, I looked down, because she had made this beautiful speech, high heels, everything. And she came back and she had on combat boots. And I looked at those combat boots and I said, you know, this woman is a warrior. And I don't think I'm ready to do this story, you know. So I didn't, but she was really brutalized by the system. I mean, they put her in a place miles and miles away from where she lived, where she couldn't work. You know, she really was tortured and treated very badly by the system. But they couldn't make it after she got out for whatever reason. But like, this is why it's up for us to write about women, because there's so many women I could have written about in the civil rights movement. You know, Joanne Robinson, who had set the stage before Coretta and Martin even did anything, Alabama school teacher. We have to go on and on, you know, about writing about women. Just like the King story, one half of it told, the other one now is being told now. So, she's being marginalized. And I hope that y'all saw this wonderful film, Hidden Figures. If you don't, these are the black women who made such a contribution to the space system. Who knew that story? You know, who knew what some of the women would do? I mean, some of you need to write about yourselves even. Because if you don't tell the story, somebody's going to tell it. You may not like what they tell. You better get there first, I'll tell you that.
Another question? Yes, sir.
Yes, so after writing this book and going through the process and after hearing Mrs. King's life story, did any of your life perspectives change?
Well, that's good.
And how so?
That's a good question. When I met Mrs. King in the 70s, you know, I was not a minister. I don't think I was a good Christian, because when I look back on some of the things that I did and said, I can't believe it. she would invite me to her home. I remember this time she invited me. And she said, we're going to go to church tomorrow at Ebenezer. And I remember saying, well, do I have to go, Mrs. King? I can't imagine me saying that, you know. And then I first met her. She was in a basement of a church, a theological seminary. And she had all these blueprints about how she wanted to build the King Center and how she wanted to have a reflecting pool and all of this. And I said to her, do you know anybody ever built such institutions? She said, no. I said, well, who's going to guide you? I need to talk to him. She said, the Holy Spirit's going to guide me. I was at a clue. I had no clue what she was talking about, you know. But because I saw her, you know, the best sermon ever preached is the one somebody lives. And so she didn't have the great scholar. She didn't know. She understood Barth from her husband, teaching her about Barth and Tillich and all of these, you know, theologians and Cone. But that wasn't what made her a good Christian. It was this simple stuff, like if you see somebody on the Jericho Road, hurt him, pick him up, try to find some way to help them. I saw a woman when I traveled with her, every day she would take out her Bible, and she would read the daily word. And she would challenge me, what does this mean, Barbara? I had to learn from her nonviolence, because to me, you know, if you hit my dog, then I should hit your cat. You know, just that simple, you know, that's but you know, she had to teach me, you know, how nonviolence is something that it gets in the fabric of society and it builds up hate. And she had to teach me, you know, how even suffering can be redemptive. And so traveling with her, I never heard her speak violence. You know, I mean, you know, it's just normal that sometimes you say, the heck with it, or you're using other words or something. I mean, but she would say, Barbara, you know, don't say that like that, because all people have good in them. It'll come out sooner or later. And so seeing her gentleness and belief that you know, the troubles we're going through now, they stood up to Bull Connor, they stood up to the Klan, and with the faith in their heart that God and action would work it out. So, you know, when I look at all this stuff now, we've been through this before. I'm almost 75. I've been through this, but I didn't want to go through it again. That's the problem.
The question over here.
Protests have turned toward violence today. So what do you think Coretta and Martin would think about that?
Well, some protests turned violent in their day. And what they did, they offered an alternative. You could see that their group was not part of the violence. They were sticklers on nonviolence. They stuck to it, even when people were saying black power, you know, let's tear down the system. They say, no, we're gonna do it nonviolently. So I think that she'd be doing the same thing she'd say now. We, nonviolence that Gandhi perpetrated, you know, it worked there. Whole nonviolent program turned this whole country around. This is why women have more power. This is why the physically challenged. When gay rights was out there, many people were not for gay rights. And she stood up and she said, you know, I will not be a part of a discrimination against gay people, you know. But she would not be for violence. And she would stand out against it. I interviewed Dr. Martin Luther King's father once, and he had his son killed, and his wife was sitting playing the Lord's Prayer in church when a crazy black man walked in and killed her. And I said, how do you deal with that kind of violence? He said, first thing I do, I won't hate anybody. I won't stoop low enough to hate. And I think that's what she would be saying, that we will not hate, but we will organize and use nonviolent methods. You have them. Do you know that blacks together have a $1 trillion economy? That if they would target certain businesses that was not being respectful to them and pull that away? You know, there are many things you can do nonviolently to send a message to those who are in power.
This has really been quite a treat, a wonderful, wonderful discussion about the memoir that you have so beautifully and eloquently presented for all of us. I want to encourage everyone to get the book, read the book. It's a wonderful love story. It's a wonderful legacy story.
Okay.
And you are really to be commended and thanked for giving us another vision and another perspective on this 20th century activist and
I'd
warrior.
Like to thank the dean for opening me up and asking questions that helped me to give answers. And I still again want to thank Vita Palladino again for letting this be a place where Coretta could come home and be a part of who she was, a co-partner in one of the most effective revolutions in our time. So I thank you once again.
Well, thank you very much. Let's give her another round of applause. Thank you, Vita.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a discussion with Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds on My Life, My Love, My Legacy, the autobiography of Coretta Scott King. Moderating the discussion was the Reverend Dr. Robert Allen Hill, Dean of Boston University's Marsh Chapel. We began with an introduction by Boston University Board of Trustees member and President and CEO of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, Andrea Taylor. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jeff Turton. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.